This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Severe weather, stricter regulations, and a handful of other factors are being blamed for North Carolina's declining commercial fishing yield. Lee Jenkins has more.
June was just declared National Ocean Month by the Obama administration as part of an effort to increase awareness of the importance of America's oceanic resources and to bolster conservation efforts along the coast. This may come as good news for North Carolina's fisheries, which are now experiencing a bit of a slump in seafood supply. The amount of fish brought to market, dubbed landings, has steadily shrunk. 2013's harvest was down 12% from the previous year, and down 21% from the previous five-year average. The sharp decline in shrimp and blue crab has been especially hard on fishermen, according to Patricia Smith, information coordinator for the Division of Marine Fisheries.
Because they do make up so much of North Carolina's commercial harvest, it shows a lot in the landings whenever their landings are down.
For blue crab specifically, harvests shrank by almost 4 million pounds over the past year, while dockside value has gone up from 78 cents per pound to $1.23 per pound in that same time period. But blue crab and shrimp aren't the only declines noted. Trey McGovern of Tryon Palace Seafood says his business is noticing seafood yield shortages across the board.
We've been seeing a slight supply crunch on several things. We've seen blue crab not coming in. Same thing with shrimp, but we're also experiencing that with flounder and several other species as well.
McGovern says a below average catch is bad news for consumers.
Everybody's trying to get the same thing. You know, you're seeing it reflected in the price more than anything. The prices are increasing and your dollar's not going as far as it has in years past.
The trend extends across the market, as evidenced by landings data, says Division of Marine Fisheries Information Coordinator Patricia Smith.
We've had a decreasing trend in landings, but it has actually been the third year straight that it was an increased trend in dockside value.
There isn't much in the way of a simple solution to the problem. Everything from winter freezes to spring rains can stunt the growth of fish populations. Smaller populations, in turn, are kept off limits to fishermen, who either have to wait for them to rebound or move on to another species. According to McGovern, there are other important factors leading to decreased seafood yields.
Your fishermen are down 20-30%. 91% of America's seafood is imported. People don't consider what pollution does to the waters. It's just everything coming together has really taken a toll on the fisheries and the seafood industry in general.
One bright spot is the southern flounder market. It seems to be making a recovery in spite of regulations on gill nets and flounder's tendency to congregate with the currently restricted red drum. Whether or not this marks a shifting trend remains to be seen, as the next landings report isn't set for release until April of 2015. For Public Radio East, I'm Lee Jenkins.
Monday, May 12th, riders on the Cherry Branch Minnesot Ferry witnessed something peculiar during an afternoon crossing.
We just left Minnesot Beach. You know, as soon as we leave, we always look to the front of the ship, you know.
Carlos Kowalczewski is a ferry crewman with the North Carolina Ferry Division.
We saw this black thing swimming. First, we thought it was a dog. And we thought, well, we might have to go get that dog. And then, you know, as we got closer and closer, we looked and we got the binoculars and I got my own pair of binoculars, and I looked. I said, that's not a dog, that's a bear.
A black bear that Carlos estimates was 400 to 500 pounds was swimming near the channel that ferries use for making the Neuse River crossing. News about the bear sighting spread quickly around the vessel, and passengers exited their cars to watch.
Oh, everybody was like thrilled, you know, everybody was watching and, you know, hey, look, you know. We were right on the front of the bow of the ship, and he was right in front of us, you know, just swimming across, you know, like he didn't care, you know, minding his own business, you know. He had a mission, and, you know, that's what he was going to do, you know, and he didn't care if the ferry was there.
It took about an hour for the black bear to swim the three-mile-wide Neuse River before he landed on the Cherry Branch side in Craven County.
He got out of the water, he shook himself and just hit it out, you know, he just started running. It didn't take him, you know, no time at all to recover from the swim.
While it seems strange to see a bear swimming, it's actually not that unusual.
Get reports like that every year about this time.
Mark Jones is the supervising wildlife biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. While most black bears can swim 1 or 2 miles, he says some have been known to swim longer distances.
We've had bears swim across the Pamlico Sound, which is a much longer swim. They have a remarkable sense of smell, and I guess we can theorize they can actually smell something on the other side. They're not doing this without some idea that they've got somewhere to go.
Since black bear mating season is underway in eastern North Carolina, there are some that speculate the black bear that swam across the Neuse River was in search of a mate. However, it's also the time of the year where young male black bears are searching for new territory after being kicked out of their home range by their mothers.
They're almost always young juvenile bears that are looking for a place that they can call their own. The mother at some point won't tolerate them anymore, and large male bears are not very friendly to these young bears, so they're looking for a place they can call their own, and that's why they a lot of times take to the water.
Typically between late spring and early summer, there's an increase in bear sightings in eastern North Carolina. As bears wander into new territory, Jones says homeowners should be on alert.
They probably came from a relatively unpopulated area, and a lot of times they get into populated areas unknowingly, can run into problems around people's houses with dogs, and they can get into garbage and pet food and things like that.
As for the bear that was seen swimming across the Neuse River, he hasn't been spotted since. But ferry crewman Carlos Kolachewski was able to snap a few pictures of the bear in the water. If you'd like to see them, they're posted at our website, publicradioeast.org. This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East.
In 1984, Public Radio East began broadcasting, just one single station broadcasting classical music off of something called vinyl. Today we have 5 different frequencies offering up your choice of either classical music or NPR news. In 30 years, great things happened to Public Radio East because the people who live in this community support this station. We thank you for that and invite you to help us celebrate our 30th anniversary by making a special contribution today at publicradioeast.org or calling 800-222-9832, and thanks.
Summer is almost here, and music will fill the air again at the Fort Macon State Park starting next weekend as the Friends of Fort Macon kick off their inaugural concert of the season. Public Radio East's Mac McKee speaks with the president of the Friends of Fort Macon, Tom Kelly, about this year's concert series.
Mr. Kelly, thank you for joining us today. On June 13th, the Friends of Fort Macon will present the Cajun Zydeco Band, Unknown Tongues. Now, what's the definition of Cajun Zydeco? What kind of music is it?
Well, this is a type of music that originated down around the New Orleans and Louisiana area. It's kind of a Mardi Gras type of music. As a matter of fact, one of the things I like to say is that they turn the parade ground of Fort Macon into a Mardi Gras party when they come and play.
Have Unknown Tongues performed at Fort Macon Concert Series for quite some time?
Yes, they have. They're one of our regular groups, it seems, and they always bring a big crowd. Last year when they were at Fort Macon, we had about 800 people there, and it was a great night.
What is the Fort Macon Concert Series, and how did it get started?
Basically, the Fort Macon Concert Series started in a very low-key way about 17 years ago. We've been doing it every year since, and it seems like every year it gets a little bit bigger. And we're basically providing free concerts on Friday evenings in the summertime. And what we like to say to people is, come on in, bring a big picnic basket if you'd like. Bring your lawn chairs. You can sit up on the ramparts and watch boats come in Beaufort Inlet on your left. Watch the sunset on your right. The ocean's in front of you. And there's great music down below, and it's all for free. So it's kind of how good is that on a Friday night in Carteret County?
Do you have your events scheduled months or even a year in advance?
Yes, we do. We usually have it pretty much scheduled out by the first of the year. and some of them are repeat performers. We do seven shows in the course of the summertime because I have to schedule the shows around other events at Fort Macon. There's a lot going on there, from cannon firing demonstrations to reenactments and other kinds of things.
Can you give us a sneak peek at the concert series for, you know, a few of the concerts for the rest of the summer?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, on June 13th, we'll have the Unknown Tongues there. Then on June 20th, we have Samantha Casey and the Bluegrass Jam, another extremely popular group. They're from Goldsboro and Raleigh. Then on July 11th, we have a duo called Wild Honey, another popular local band. And we do switch it up quite a bit, as you can tell. On July 25th, we'll have the Moorhead Brass Consortium playing, and they basically play classics and pop music, all arranged for a brass ensemble. So we have quite a variety. On August 8th, we have a group called Skirson Kettner playing, another very popular group that they sort of play a bluegrassy type beach music. They like to call it seagrass or pirate rock, but in any event, whatever you want to call it, they are very popular in this area, actually up and down the Carolinas, and we're lucky to get them the last 3 years now. So they'll be wrapping up our series for us on August 8th.
And the date of the Unknown Tongues concert, once again, is June 13th, and what is the time of that show again?
June 13th. The show is begins at 7, and we encourage people to come. We leave the park open that evening, so sometimes people will come at 6 o'clock and have a picnic, dinner, and listen to the group as they're doing their sound checks and whatnot. It's just a pleasant place to be on a Friday night. So the show starts at 7 o'clock. As a matter of fact, all the shows are at 7.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Kelly, for being our guest today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. This time of year, we're really enjoying seeing the beautiful vegetable plants growing in our garden. But sometime within the next few weeks, you may wake up and suddenly see that your beautiful squash plants have seemingly melted almost overnight. More than likely, what you're seeing is the result of the squash vine borer. The squash vine borer is the larvae of a moth, but it's a moth that looks a lot like a wasp. The moth lays brown flattened eggs near the very base of the squash plant. And when those eggs hatch, the larvae, which have a brown head and a cream-colored body, burrow into the stem of the squash. And there, they do their damage. Once they destroy the inside of the stem, the plant is unable to transport water and nutrients, and it collapses. When you look at the base of the plant, you see goopy brown frass. That's, let's just say, what the larvae leaves behind. The plant stem almost looks shredded. Let's be honest. There's nothing you can do at that point to save the plant. So, how do you avoid squash vine borers? It's pretty tricky. First thing, when you're out in your garden, is to watch for the adult squash vine borer moth. They have front wings that are a metallic green and rear wings that are transparent with black or brown margins and veins. Their body is orange and black, often in a ringed pattern surrounding the abdomen, or it may look like they have black dots down the abdomen. If you see this moth hovering over squash plants, flitting down every once in a while to land just for a moment, it's laying eggs. Get rid of it. Although most moths fly only at night, the squash vine borer also flies during the day. And because squash blossoms need to have pollinators in order to set fruit, you can't cover the plant with any material during the day to keep the moth away. But you can try covering the plants at night, so at least there's some hours of the day when the squash vine borer can't get in and cause harm. Next, check the very base of the stems of squash daily for the eggs of the borer. They are about the size of a pencil point, brown and flattened. If you see those eggs, take your finger and remove them, being careful not to damage the stem yourself. And what about pesticides, you might be asking? Well, once the egg is laid, there's little that a pesticide can do to harm the moth, and the moth touches the plant for such a short moment that any pesticides on the plant probably won't harm the moth. So your only hope is that you have a speck of pesticide in the tiny spot where that young larvae, just after it hatches, is going to burrow into the plant, and that it will ingest that pesticide and die before it does damage. That's pretty tricky. So just blitzing your plants with pesticides, well, it may not do the trick. But you can try covering the very base of the plants with a pesticide. Some of the organic pesticides that can be used in the garden, such as pyrethrins, neem oil, they may do the trick. And making sure to repeat the coverage regularly, especially if it rains. But do keep in mind that even this probably won't save your plants. Once the larvae are inside the stalk, you can try making a tiny slit lengthwise, not back and forth, and remove the larvae with a pair of tweezers, and then bury the stem in soil. But your best bet, you may want to plant as early as possible in order to avoid the squash vine borer, and plant your plants 1-2 weeks apart. That way, after you've gotten a few squash off each plant and the borer kills it, you have another plant coming along to try again. Good luck with the squash vine borers. I've finally stopped growing squash here in coastal North Carolina because I'm lucky enough to be surrounded by amazing vegetable farmers who produce the squash for me. But if you're growing them, keep an eye out for those moths, watch for the eggs, and do your best to keep your squash going as long as you can. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
The recorded output of Carlborough resident Jonathan Bird has been varied. World music on the sea and sky, mood spaghetti western-style music on the law and the lonesome, and electric folk on This Is the New That. His most recent recording, no surprise, offers something different, though, with a focus provided by his home state. George Olson has more.
An album that plays out as a love song to North Carolina isn't too surprising from a man who makes the following statement.
I grew up in North Carolina, and my family's been here for many generations, and I'm not going anywhere, and I love it here. I love the culture and the food and the music, and that was bound to come out sooner or later as a songwriter.
Carlborough resident and seventh-generation North Carolinian Jonathan Bird. What's surprising about his collection of songs about or inspired by his home state is where it was recorded.
When we did a tour, me and my friend Corin Raymond, he lives in Toronto, and I was going up there to do a tour in Western Canada, and we were coming back to Toronto at the end of it and playing a show, and he said, you know, if you want to record, we've got all these great players here, and I knew exactly who he was talking about. I knew all the players. We had played together some. So I said, sure, well, I'll think about it. I'll look at the songs I've got and see if I've got something that works. And I did look at what I had, and I had a lot of songs about North Carolina. So I started sort of sculpting a North Carolina album.
A white oak wood, it's a shady tree, slow to grow and a sight to see. All I need is some white oak wood.
So North of the Border was produced a CD of songs pertaining to North Carolina. Jonathan Bird's new CD, Cackalack, mentions locales familiar to residents, whether it's the Barrier Islands or the Cape Fear or Scuppernong Rivers. But Jonathan isn't just dropping place names in an effort to tie the disc to his home state. He's trying to present the diversity of styles, which he feels are indicative of North Carolina's musical leanings.
For the album in general, I think I was trying to put things together the way they were put together in an earlier day, and the way I feel like in North Carolina, if I just get together to play with some people, there are all of those things. Like, people know some bluegrass songs, people know some old-timey songs, people know some country songs, somebody might play a current popular song, and all those musical styles are evident.
Some of those styles are evident in the CD's title track, Cackalack, which would feel at home in a country, bluegrass, or old-time jam. The word cackalack is of undetermined origin, and in my own observations, sometimes used as a pejorative in describing North Carolina. That's also Jonathan Bird's experience, and an experience he seeks to change.
I'd actually heard it from other people. Say I was touring up north, I'd say I'm from North Carolina, and they go, oh, North Cackalacky. It's sort of like they were making fun of the way we talk or something like that. It took me aback a couple times, but I felt like I wanted to own that word. It's such a fun thing to say. The sound of it sounds like a chicken cackling. It sounds like a train on the tracks. It sounds like a fire crackling. There's so many things that sort of that are North Carolina that are in that word to me. I mean, poetically, just sonically, that I wanted to own that word again and make it mean all those things.
Cackalack, cackalack. Cackalack, cackalack. Cackalack, cackalack. I'm on a 95 South and I ain't going to play.
The old-time music Jonathan played in the earlier mentioned jam sessions is particularly close to his heart, really where his music starts. It's long presented a bit of a challenge to him, a performer enamored of old-time music who records all original music, as with the CD Cackalack. The disc features one of his earliest songwriting efforts, Scuppernong, a track that tries to balance original and old-time that he'd written several years ago but never seemed to quite fit the mood of a CD until now.
When I first started writing songs, I was inspired because I was hanging out with people who were playing old-time music. And they play songs from the old song canon, and you hear the same songs over and over again, and they're great songs. But I was just starting to write songs, and I thought, these people could use some more songs. I wonder if I could write a song that sounded so much like one of these songs that they would just think it was an old song and they'd start playing it.
Broken in my heart and broken in my soul. I am broken, darling, make me whole.
Though enamored of old-time music, Jonathan Bird's recorded output has run the gamut. A new Jonathan Bird CD seems to almost always present a new Jonathan Bird. Musically, he's always been a bit restless, which may have been a mirror on his actual life. Now he's married, owns a house. On the day we spoke, he had to excuse himself for several minutes to talk with a repairman, and has a one-year-old child. He explores the move from restlessness to domesticity in the song Wild Ponies, which draws a metaphor between the fictional relationship in the song with the ponies of the Outer Banks.
The song itself is about wildness. I think at the time that I wrote it was reconciling the idea of freedom and what freedom means. And do I have to be sort of wild and homeless and reckless to be free? Or is there another kind of freedom in having a community and having a home and having someone to come home to? So the song was dealing with all those issues with this guy and girl in the song, but I think internally I was dealing with those issues within myself and settling down and buying a house and having a child.
But she didn't stay here like she didn't stay there. Always looking for somewhere a little greener. And every time I see the ponies run, scared and hungry, wild and young, I see her.
And like those who do settle down, Jonathan Bird's vision tends to look further out into the future than what's happening this weekend. That subject of past generations and generations to come provides the impetus behind his song, Oak Tree.
In England, they say, in England, 100 miles is a long way. And in America, 100 years is a long time. And I wanted to bring that sense of feeling small and just recognizing that there are things that are larger than us, that we can't really take things that are happening right now too seriously. We need to put them in this larger frame in order to get perspective on where we are. And what we need to do right now is just in order to keep the planet alive for 7-8 generations from now. I mean, my family's been in North Carolina now for 8 generations. My son is 8th generation in North Carolina. So it's evident to me that we could easily have 8 more generations, and I want them to have a beautiful place to live, too.
Well, I was an oak tree. It took 1,000 years to grow. And I've seen kingdoms come and go. I've seen the losers turn to lords and back again. I held the rebels when they hung them from my limb.
The new CD by Carrboro resident Jonathan Bird is entitled Cackalack. I'm George Olson.
It's when they came for me.
Jonathan Bird comes to Oriental next weekend for a free performance sponsored by the Pamlico Musical Society. Jonathan performs along with Jacob Johnson on the lawn of the Oriental Marina next weekend, Saturday the 14th, starting at 4:30.
And the captain never saw the coming storm that swept around the Cape and took us by surprise, and only 8 survived. I was a campfire, a pile of driftwood in the sand, the only comfort in this land. And 8 hungry sailors roasted acorns that they'd found.